So thank you for being here, coming out on a Wednesday night when you could be looking for whales or something productive like that. And since we are recording this evening, thank you to those who might listen later, or for those of you who fall asleep tonight and then decide to listen later. I haven't spoken here in a long time. And not for lack of choices. Oh, first I should say, I see some people I haven't seen before. My name is Dana, and I'm a priest here at Santa Cruz Zen Center. I haven't been here in a while, and not for lack of invitation. I think it's really, I haven't felt like adding a lot more words, or I didn't feel like I had a lot to add. Just in terms of, you know, kind of discursive study of Zen. In some ways, I think we're way too wordy, period. So I want to say thank you to my teachers, Catherine Thanis, Jean Bush, my dog Morgan. If you look on the website, my dog Morgan is listed as one of my beloved teachers. When I sent a little bio into San Francisco Zen Center, I wrote all the stuff you're supposed to write, you know, when you were lay ordained, when you were priest ordained, when you got transmission, who your teachers were. And they wrote me back and said, one of the practice leaders, and said, this is good, but we're adding a line about Morgan. And in fact, that's right. So if you read the bio that's on the Santa Cruz website, that actually, I didn't write all of that. That some of that is from someone in San Francisco who has seen me up close with my dog and said, she's clearly your teacher. So I want to talk about Zazen tonight. I want to talk about Soto Zen, and I'm going to be maybe a little bit out of the box because I'm just kind of feeling like that lately. First, I want to tell you a little story of a conversation I had with my next-door neighbor. I live up in faculty housing at the university, and Richard, my next-door neighbor, has been a math professor up there for, I don't know, about 25, 30 years. And a few years ago, Richard said to me, kind of excited, he goes, I solved it. And I said, solved what? He goes, the one thing I've been working on for 17 years. And, you know, it's a little bit different across the different disciplines at the university, but Richard's been looking at the same problem for 17 years. And he had just about given up on this solving this problem. And please don't ask me later what it is, because I can't, I don't remember. Something kind of esoteric. He had given up on it, and he was talking to one of his friends, and his friend said to him, why is it important to solve that problem? And Richard was, I think, incensed that anyone would ask him, like, really, you spent 17 years of your life on this, Richard? And Richard explained it to him, and his friend, who's also a mathematician, got very excited by it, and they had a series of, I don't know, email, Skype exchanges over the next year, and Richard solved the damn thing. Mm-hmm. And now is, you know, kind of in great demand internationally, nationally, to come and speak about this problem. Whereas for 17 years, plus maybe the other 9 years that he was working on other things, he was pretty kind of lived in relative obscurity. And I'm just mentioning this story because I think this question, why does it matter, is one that I've been chewing on for a while. What does it matter? The vows, the dress, the ordinations, the teachings, the zazen, all of it. Now, I feel like I'm not really supposed to say that to you. I'm supposed to say, are you sitting enough zazen? Or, you know, do you go to enough ceremonies? Are you participating at a level that, you know, is commensurate with your devotion and commitment to Zen practice? But I do think these basic questions are ones that we should ask regularly, if not often. So, you know, one of the things that I've been away for a little while here, and, you know, after a pretty intense period of co-leading the practice period with Jean in 2017, and I don't know, I feel like we did something else after the practice period, maybe the thing with Joanna Macy. And then, you know, being a member of the board and then subbing for Edie as president when she went to Tassajara. That new shiny building out in the corner there has been a project that's been ongoing for a long time. 6 years? 7 years almost, probably. And after kind of an intense period of presence, I've had a relatively short but, you know, reasonable time for a contraction. And I wanted to, in this period, evaluate my own relationship to Zen practice, in particular to Soto Zen. You know, I kind of have been thinking about organizational issues having to do with small nonprofits like ours. And just, you know, kind of more generally, my own belonging to this world of Dharma. And, you know, once you kind of become a priest or become a transmitted teacher, you have an obligation to think about these things, I think. And I've really been asking, like I say, the most basic kinds of questions. What does it matter? Are the teachings accurately translated? And if they are we interpreting them correctly? What is it about, you know, 6th, 7th, 8th, 9th century Dharma from India, China, and Japan? Is it really transferable to 21st century Western civilization? And what's essential? What's most important? And, you know, I'm just going to... Oh, and there's a very specific thing that I've been chewing on, which is, what does it mean for me as someone who's Asian American, who's Japanese American, who I come from the ancestry and kind of national identity of this practice that originated, that we owe a great debt to, back to Dogen Zenji in the 1200s and even before. And honestly, I'm just going to tell you, you know, I've been kind of gone back and forth on this, on what it means to be, well, the only Japanese American. There are very few Asian American teachers across the Buddha Dharma, at least in the West, and particularly in Zen. And what does it mean for me? And, you know, it's been a kind of very important set of interrogations of my own internal process, my relationship to how Dharma is taught and how it's expressed. I remember one particular time I was sitting at Tassajara and one of the teachers sort of started talking like a fortune cookie. And, you know, kind of in that broken Asian type talk, like, well, I don't know, I can't remember exactly what was said. And I remember thinking, that's messed up, man. Like, that's an idea about what you think was the original teaching, and actually it's a stereotype and personification of Asian culture. So, you know, I can't talk about all of this stuff tonight. I just want to talk about one aspect of some of these big questions that I've been opening up, which is principally about sitting meditation. You know, Shohaku Okamura, one of the Japanese teachers, says, you know, this is a good-for-nothing thing that we do. And recently, oh, by the way, you know, you probably know this is graduation week at the university. This is also Father's Day weekend. And, you know, there's a lot of people in black gowns running around the university. It just makes me feel so at home. But the upshot of some of what I've been thinking about is that, you know, and it's always difficult to make generalizations, but I feel like we make it a lot more complicated than it needs to be. And I say this in part because, Patrice and Jean and I, thankfully with the help of Mary, have done a number of things up at the university, kind of doing, you know, nobody calls me up and says, hey, can you teach me Shikantaza? No, nobody does that. People call us up and say, would you be willing to come and do a session with us on mindfulness? And I'm a little bit like, we don't exactly do mindfulness, but I'm going to roll with this. Mm-hmm. And Patrice and I have done a couple trainings up at the university that have been very gratifying, even though, you know, if we were to be really technically correct about it, we'd be like, we're not what you want. But in the end, we were what they wanted, you know, because we were flexible about how we translate what we understand to be Dogen's teaching about just sitting. So more complicated than it needs to be, the forms, the ceremonies, everybody's so serious. I come in, offer incense, you know, flat down the zagu, and, you know, sometimes, just sometimes, I feel like, what is this, a funeral? You know, like, some of this stuff is actually very entertaining. And also, I want to say, in Soto Zen, it is one of the most structured forms of Buddhism. So there are teachings, there's a lot of forms about how you come in the Zendo, how you bow to the seat and away from the seat, how you offer incense if you're doing that, and so on. And there's always something else to learn, right? So, oh, you read the Shobo Genzo, have you read this other version, translation of the Shobo Genzo? Oh, you've read the Platform Sutra, what about this translation of that sutra? I feel a little bit, and this may sound a little bit blasphemous, but I feel, at least for me, it becomes a kind of grasping thing about the next thing, when really, I think the fundamental thing is you're just supposed to sit and look at the dang wall and do this good-for-nothing thing. You know, we talk about insight, about being aware of awareness, about the mind being aware of what's happening in the body. And that's very important, I think, just to be a human being alive in the 21st century, to know where your breath is, to understand better your own process of tightening up, of grasping, of finding your breath. This is where we work in order to be kind and to be compassionate toward others. And it really starts here with us. I mean, I think sometimes, you know, many different sects of Buddhism have this. We say we want to save all beings. And so you'll hear people, particularly in the, you know, who are relatively new to this practice before they're in sufficient pain at the grasping, they're saying, well, I just want to, you know, save all people. And I want to bring peace on earth. And I want to, you know, have people understand all of these things around me. And I think for many teachers, we want to say, no, dude, just sit and follow your breath. That's your job. You can't understand other people's suffering really until you can grapple deeply with your own. And this is not a one-shot deal, typically, you know. Very few people come to the cushion and say, I got it, I'm good to go. You know, very, very few. And if you do have that, that's great, but it disappears in the next nanosecond. So good luck with that, you know. I think, you know, this, we often cite Dogen, you know, and say that, you know, our purpose is to study the self, to drop the self, to realize the 10,000, the myriad, let the myriad things come forth and slough off body and mind. And, you know, from where I sit and from this past period of being away, teaching elsewhere, doing little workshops, I kind of feel like this is the main thing, the only thing, the lifelong practice. And one of the ways I think that we can evaluate how we're doing with this lifelong practice is how much we're concerned about other people. Like, this is a really, I mean, in some ways it's a solo practice that we do collectively. But if we find ourselves saying things like, well, actually, I think to be a good Buddhist, you should do this. You know, you should only wear these kind of clothes. You should only eat these kinds of things. You should or shouldn't do drugs. You should or shouldn't eat these particular kinds of foods. You should care about these issues. I mean, I think, and this is not to say that there is not something very deep and important about being engaged in the world, but when we're talking with other people about this, I think that's not necessarily part of the original practice, which is to, as Brad Warner says, sit down and shut up. He's not the most eloquent guy. But, you know, there are lots of different, more eloquent teachers who basically say the same thing. And I think it's a really hard thing to just sit on this, whatever it is, like 30 square inches, and mind your own business. Because it's part of our human nature to be evaluative and judging about how we are in relation to others. But I think one of the things about this practice is that it teaches you a certain amount of humility, which is that you really don't know. You know, you may think someone is being mean to you or nice to you or agrees with you or doesn't agree with you, but these things are fairly, you know, kind of one inch deep kinds of judgments that we make about our Sangha members, our family members, and so on. And I think it's really this internal process of working. Now, you know, one of the things that we often cite from Dogen is that the self doesn't exist. You know, you kind of study the self to drop the self. I just want to say, because I think this is something that I forget over and over again, that we hold up and reify this notion of no self. And that's not exactly accurate, right? Everybody's got a self. It's just that it changes. It's not a fixed self. So technically, moment to moment, breath to breath, day to day, week to week, year to year, that body and mind is changing. And I think the teaching is that yourself, the self, is kind of incoherent. Like only some of it is really available to us, or visible sensing, and we can sense the self only to a certain level often. And then there are some things about some selves that I think are invariant. For example, part of Dana is, I'm Japanese American. I always have been, and I'm pretty sure I always will be. And that's a whole karma of relationships and history that I can't change. That's not the same as Karen or Patrice or Stan. And, you know, one of our teachings is that you can't really know someone else's experience of this. And I do think often we get very close to it and we're very sympathetic, empathetic, compassionate about the kind of depth and diversity of people's experiences. But mostly we don't know. So this business about the self, that this ideal that we drop ourselves and then we're all the same, I think that's actually a misunderstanding of what Dogen is saying.
But not knowing is most intimate.
That's what they say. That's what they say. So I just want to mention a couple of other things about some of the thoughts that I've been going over about kind of how we teach Dharma, how we relate to Dharma. And maybe these would fall under kind of the kind of broad category of translation and interpretation. You know, Suzuki Roshi once famously said something like, you should know something about Zazen, but actually it's not that important that you know anything about Buddhism. And I think that, again, you know, kind of to reiterate and kind of retread the ground that Shohaku Okamura treads on this is just do the good-for-nothing thing and look at the wall. But we often, and this is, I think this is true of most sects of Buddhism, there's a kind of canon of teachings that we go to. And depending on who you are and where you are in Dharma, or where you are in the Buddha Dharma world, some texts are going to be more important than others. But I just want to talk specifically about some of the Soto texts and say that these are actually, in my view, really problematic. And I'll just give you two really quick examples. One is, you know, we often work with koans. We have this kind of stereotype thing that, oh, Rinzai people work with koans and Zen people work with shikantaza. And, you know, the famous koan that the monk asked Joshu, does a dog have Buddha nature? You know that one? And ineffably, Joshu says, moo. And then, you know, monks go off for like years at a time and think about what does mu mean? Are we talking about kind of ultimate reality and emptiness, non-dualism? So it turns out, according to some of the scholars of Buddhism, people who read the classical Chinese or in the original Chinese or Japanese, that Joshu didn't say that. That's not the right attribution. Somebody else said it. Joshu's famous for a lot of other things. Joshu's the Nansen and the cat. But he's the Mu koan is not Joshu. And, you know, when I read this stuff, I think, well, gee, what are we doing? You know, we're reproducing a liturgy and a canon that may not be historically accurate. And what does that mean for us to do that? What are we thinking? I mean, obviously, we're very reliant on people who can read in the original and translate for us. But what are we repeating when we do this? Just another really quick example. You know, we use this term, shikantaza, right, to describe the just sitting. I mean, there are t-shirts made of just sitting. And often, if you go hear other Dharma teachers talk, what they'll say is, well, our way is just sitting. And actually, there's a kind of interesting historical debate about whether or not Dogen, what he meant by that. And there's some talk that actually he didn't mean literally just sitting. He was actually responding to something that his teacher, Ru Jing, said, which was to the monks, which is, man, you guys are just sleeping. And then there's this whole, you know, I don't want to weigh in on this because I'm not an Asian studies scholar. I don't read Japanese and classical Chinese, so I'm not going to, you know, weigh in on the accuracy of this. But I just want to, I'm reporting to you tonight that there are these scholarly debates about whether or not we, the practitioners of Soto Zen, have this exactly right. And I say this not to pull the rug out from under you, but for us to begin to think, you know, kind of broadly about what some of this might mean for the practice. And where I come with this is, or where I end up with this, is that the practice of sitting and looking at the wall, regardless of what else we say about it, this is a core practice of most Zen sects. There's nothing, I'm not sure, I mean, I could be wrong about this, I'm not sure there's anything special about Soto Zen that's different than, say, you know, a 14-day Vipassana retreat in which people are also sitting 40-minute periods and being talked to about insight and mind awareness and all of that. And I say this in part because this is something that I reflect on both as an academic, but also as a Japanese-American, as someone who comes from this ancestry and also understands that the world has changed a great deal since the 6th, 7th, 8th, 9th, 12 centuries. And I just think these are some questions that we collectively need to think about and open up. It turns out that when you read these scholars, there's about a half a dozen of them in the United States, and then there's like 300 of them in Japan who do this kind of work. And obviously I only read the ones that are in the United States who are writing in English. And they are a kind of little clatch of about 6 to 8 people who have their own set of in-group conversations. And they all agree that, you know, Zen in Japan is the product of very specific historical, cultural contexts that are linked to the rise of the Meiji government, which is a particular period in Japanese history that's post-Dogen, and that the only way to understand the evolution of Buddhism, in particular Soto Zen, has to do with its relationship to state and government politics and Japan and the kind of introduction of modern society. And, in some ways I think that should be a relief to us, because, you know, when we do this practice, this, you know, aspiration that we're going to save all beings, we're going to work here to work out to save all beings, that we live in a particular historical period. That, in obvious ways, it's dramatically different than 12th century Japan. How that matters, I don't know, but I'm pretty sure that it matters. All religions have this, not just Zen and not just Buddhism. This is something about kind of the practice of religions. It's always in relationship to a cultural context. So I want to kind of, as I've been drawing back and doing a little bit of teaching elsewhere, been really kind of drawn to think about these bigger questions, because I think the survival of this good-for-nothing thing that we do, looking at the wall, is going to depend on our ability to articulate its importance for this one to save all of everyone outside of us. And I know some people are probably thinking, oh, no, that's too much stuff to think about here, you know? Just want to sit and face the wall, and somehow that'll translate outward. To do so, I think maybe is not paying attention to the fact that we live in a particular time that for which there is a tremendous boom in Buddhism. I mean, tremendous boom. You go to, you know, other centers and you see like 50, 100 people coming for an introductory thing. Buddhism is so popular. You probably have this happen too. I have people lecturing me about Zen who don't know anything about Zen. I'll just give you a really quick example, and then I'll move to close here so we can have some conversation. So a lot of you know that my dog is very sick and dying, and very grateful to Jean and Patrice for helping me take care of her. Unfortunately, they're both here tonight, so they're not home with her. But I was telling someone about her dying, and he practices at another Zen center. And he said, oh man, that's great, this is it, you get to work with impermanence. And I just said, stop, no more. Because honestly, if it were socially acceptable, I'd hit you right now, so don't say anything else. But this is kind of the era in which we live, is that people say, oh, Zen, that's so cool, it's so relaxing. I'm like, you haven't done a sesshin if you think it's relaxing. People say it's like yoga, right? I go, well, I mean, thanks Tassajara, all those Zen and yoga retreats, people say, that's yoga, right? I go, well, kind of like Shavasana, but not as comfortable. So I think, this is part of the context in which we live, in which there's a tremendous kind of spread of both popularity, desire, interest, in what this practice is. And as you know, if you practice Soto Zen, a lot of times people will say, oh man, it's so hard. I think maybe, you know, I have ADD, I can't do that. That's too long to sit. Or, you know, I'll come back when I can do that better. And, you know, our ability to make this accessible, to bring it forward into the 21st century, to make sense of what we're doing in a way that's not just kind of coming from habitual orthodoxy, I think will be key for both all of us to have a lot of company, but also to help the world. To help the world. You know, I'm very aware that in me, that I do a fair amount of grasping. And it's hard to do this practice and sit because I think there's a lot that rolls in your head about, okay, you're supposed to think of not thinking. What the heck is that? Okay, wait, I had a thought. I'm going to go back to thinking of non-thinking. And the more we wrap the words around it, I think in some ways the more we get away from it. Mm-hmm. Catherine used to say, I'm not going to actually give you instructions on this. I'm going to give you the posture. And that's the external structural part. It's your job to deal with the interiority, to seek the inside. And, you know, it ends up sometimes sounding tremendously kind of vague in that so-called inscrutable Asian way, right? I mean, even Ivanka Trump now is tweeting some Chinese proverb. You know, I think this content of our practice, what we do, it's very difficult, but it's also just easy, really simple. The more we add to it, the more we put, you know, steps in front that where we say, okay, now you need to take this class, you could take this practice period, you should do this. I think we're giving ourselves more to think about. So I'm very like, don't think about it, just sit there. Okay, so you're building a bookcase, whatever, you know. This is what we do together, and it's I think it's after 20 years of doing this that it's somewhat dishonest to say that, you know, you just drop into thinking, not thinking. We all have this stuff that goes on. This is there's a lot of ordinary living and dying that's going on, you know. And by the way, homage to Jordan Thorne, who was the Chief Financial Officer of San Francisco Zen Center, been there for many, many, many decades, passed away this last Sunday. And, you know, this, it's very difficult unless it's right in your backyard that you're thinking about the great matter. But that's, you know, basically what's at stake. So, thank you very much. Maybe would you like to ask questions or comments or... or not. Mary Tustin.
Dana, thank you so much for being Dana. And as I hear your words talking about the possibility that most of what we do is probably irrelevant here and there, I also found myself feeling at the moment that you gave me great grounding in my version of practice. And I thank you.
Thank you. Reverend.
So where do you land with all this as one who, at least for the time being, has the attire and where do you see yourself going with this? How do you think it's most important to support other beings?
I think it's really crucial to sit. I think the amount that you sit, the length of time that a period is relatively arbitrary. I mean, one of the scholarly debates is whether or not Dogen really meant sitting, literally. And there's a fair amount of evidence that maybe he didn't mean sitting literally, even though that's what we adhere to in this practice. I mean, I've had now two different scholars, two of this group of eight, say to me, no, 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 that's not what they were doing. So, on the other hand, I know that it's very beneficial. I see it all the time. You can feel it in the room if you're that kind of person. But I think, you know, Zazen is not always everybody's way. And that does not mean that you can't be a Buddhist or a Soto Zen Buddhist. I mean, for me, I feel like grief has always been my way in. Always. And I would suspect that for many of us in the room, a kind of level of sorrow and grief about losses, people that we've lost that have gone too soon, sicknesses, untimely, sudden passings, that kind of suffering, you know, these are the great questions that most religions try to deal with. I did not, when I first came to Zen, think, what a great idea, I'm going to plaster my butt to the cushion for 40 minutes, 5 days a week. You know? I have at times been very vigilant about that. But as it turns out, and again, this is from the scholars, there is nothing that says how often or how long and with what effect comes the sitting. And I find this somewhat alarming myself.
Why?
Because my orthodoxy and how I was taught was that that's what you do. That is the heart of this practice. And what would it mean to change the heart of the practice and say, actually, the heart of the practice is to study the self, whether you're on or off the cushion? I think being on the cushion is very instructive, because this admonition, you know, sit down, shut up, try not to move, try not to disturb other people, that is so difficult for us in the West, I think. Maybe in modern world, in modern countries around the world.
Can I say the closet for me is mostly about loosening the grasping. It's not one way necessarily, but it's a loosening of the grasping, because otherwise I would have to pretty much think my way into a, or try to solve a problem through my thinking. So It's through Zazen, for me, that works well in that way. I think, like a lot of things in Zen are really approximations. They're not really like absolutes, just ways of looking towards and seeing what works for you. And I appreciate what you said about why does it matter? You know, because that's a big question right there. And
Thank you, Ken. Kathy, can I come back to you? Did I answer your question?
I think it might be an ongoing conversation.
Okay.
And I'm really appreciating that you're checking in about what you've been up to. It's very encouraging to see you and hear you.
Thank you. Thank you. Would anyone else like to comment? Stan.
Yes.
Stan Hope.
I think the next step that I would like to hear is, where do we, as a Zen center, how can we make it more adjustable to changing times, specifically now in the digital age?
Yeah. That's a big question.
Yes.
Board members, are you listening? Practice leaders, are you listening? I mean, I think, you know, a lot of Zen centers are doing online courses, they're doing, you know, distance learning type things. Certainly there's a softening about participation, you know. I don't know the answers to these questions, but I know that accessibility is really important, because let's face it, if you're going to school, you're working, this cannot be a practice just for retired people.
Yeah.
You know? And it cannot be a practice for people with kids. If we're going to, you know, if we don't make some modifications. So, you know, I have noticed that a number of the workshops that Patrice and I did up at the university, the people that wanted to learn mindfulness, we gave instruction and we did maybe like 5 minutes, 10 minutes. And we were very careful not to say, actually, you need to do this for 40 minutes every day. Because we both know that that's not the magic number, you know. And there are a lot of Soto Zen centers now that have 30-minute periods or 20-minute periods. Or, you know, at Insight, they do 40 minutes on, 40 minutes walking. Or 30 minutes on, 40 minutes walking. And not kinhin, but like traipsing around the woods, you know, like walking. Mindfully. So I don't know the answer to that, but that's something that I think has to come from a collective group around what works for us. So thank you, Stan. Mary.
Well, I missed having you here. It's really nice to see you sitting in that seat and listening to your voice again.
Thank you.
And when I think about part of the reason that I come here and I sit, is I think it does help you quiet your mind, and it helps you not believe what you think, so that you are less judgmental and you're more open to really meeting other people where they're at. And I think that, you know, you talked about compassion, and that one of the maybe premises is that through this practice we'll be compassionate to other people. And I think probably one of the biggest things that I've gotten out of it is self-compassion. Mm-hmm. I think that for many of us, it's easier to sort of be compassionate to others than it is to ourselves. Mm-hmm. And so I think that has been just a wonderful gift that I've got, that I remember that I have to be as compassionate to myself as to other people. Mm-hmm. And my heart goes out to you for Morgan.
Thank you.
And you'll be happy to know the noontime meditations are still going on.
Yeah.
And Meg Corman and I wrote a grant, and we will now have a mindfulness class that will start in the fall.
That's great.
That'll be free for faculty, staff, and students that want to come.
Nice. Thank you very much. Anybody else? Lori.
Well, you know, I'm a big proponent and admirer of people who ask questions. I think... as a practicing Catholic in a very Orthodox kind of religion, I ask questions that you're not supposed to ask, and feel like that's an important thing to do, because I think that it's my gift to the world, and I think it's nice to listen to you say the same thing here. You didn't leave, you know, you are here and asking them questions here from the first people here, encouraging us who are here to ask those questions, and I really like that. Mm-hmm. Because it gives me permission to carry on as I, you know, continue to do that. And, you know, I have no idea what Buddhism is good for, except for, I always say, I have no idea what kind of a Buddhist I am, but I'm a way better Catholic. I have this grade that I judge everything by, and if it doesn't pass the Buddhist test, the Catholic test, and the 12-step test, because I also do, then it's not any good, and I throw it out. Mm-hmm. And almost everything that I completely believe will pass those tests. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, you have to work with it, mm-hmm. but you can. And I find it, you know, really a gift that I have, the kind of tortured path that I have. So I would love that you're, sitting there also asking these questions. Yes, another companion asking those questions, the ones you're not supposed to ask.
Thank you. I do think that there are, actually are many Zen teachers that are asking these questions. And... I mean, people that I talk to both here and beyond here, you know, they say, Dogen said, I go, that's not true. And they go, how do you know? I go, here, you want to read Stephen Hine, you want to read Griffith Folk, you want to read Carl Bielefeld? It's not true, you know. It's just how we push it And how long can we do that, you know, to kind of have a canon that's not... I mean, the point of having a set of views is that they have to... They're always flexible and kind of related to the current historical moment. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, they're just ideas. Liz.
Yeah, I ask these questions too, and I wonder how much for people come to Zen Center... off the street. I feel like this practice makes sense for me and is an incredible stabilizing influence in my life, a way to let my mind quiet down and kind of live from another place. But I probably wouldn't have come in the door if I hadn't gone in the door at Green Gulch, where you don't go out for a while.
Right. Right.
So, and I kind of didn't know what I was getting into. And so, and also, but just having the company of all those dinner conversations and lunch conversations and living with people, and like just expressing that they wanted to find a way of living daily life where the spiritual side was more awake or present.
Mm-hmm.
That's interesting. My sister-in-law came looking for me at the Japanese Cultural Fair on Saturday, and I wish I'd been here. It was over in the park. And she said, felt like a place that I didn't belong. Felt like there was kind of like an in-club, and I didn't fit in. So, you know, probably that's a lot. You know, certainly there's her personal karma. But I also wonder what is our idea of the center that could be more inclusive? I don't know.
Thank you. I don't think you're asking me this as a question, and I certainly don't know the answers to this, but I do know, I mean, the funniest dang thing is when people come up to you and they go, what's up with the bibs? And, you know, I'm supposed to say, oh, that's Buddha's robe, which usually is not directly enlightening for the person who's asking. So sometimes just out of pure... mean-spiritedness, I say, it's a cult. And then, you know, I add something, but I do think, you know, we should at the very least have a sense of humor about that we seem like a closed club. And would we have the same, what do I want to call it, like valence in public life if we were not in the robes? Or in the Rakusus, right? It's always a question about the form and formality. I do think sometimes, you know, the Rakusu, the robes, people have been practicing for a while, you know, it's a mixture of how we relate to that. Like, I want to be that, right? I mean, I know people who many times over could have been a priest who chose not to. And it's such an honorable way to think about Zen practice, I think. And it's a very individual decision, but I think, you know, the rank and hierarchy, the step and all of that, you know, it creates a certain level of projection. So, I mean, I honestly, tonight I thought about just coming in wearing my jeans and my t-shirt, which is what I'm most comfortable in, and wear a rakusu. But I'm also very aware that, you know, depending on the context, the formality is very functional. Like, you're not going to ordain someone in your rakusu kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But anyway, thank you. Sorry, that was a long, wandering non-answer to your comments. Thank you for the comments. You know, it's 7:30. What do you say we just take this out to the patio and say hello to one another?
Mm-hmm.
All right. You know, I just want to say this one last thing as we get ready to close here. This chant we're about to do, the vows. Beings are numberless, I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible, I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless, I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable, I vow to become it. About 4 or 5 years ago, Jean gave a lecture about this and said, you know, actually, the real meaning, the spirit of this chant is you want to take the I and get out of it, right? Because honestly, the conceit of our practice is that we're actually doing something when you know what you're doing is nothing, looking at the wall, right? And, you know, Catherine, when she did an interview many, many years ago that got replayed prior to the book event here on March 17th, she said to this poor radio interviewer, she just talked circles around this poor guy, and she recited actually Cobencino's version of this, which some of you know. Beings are numberless, they will save themselves. Delusions are inexhaustible, they will end themselves. Dharma gates are boundless, therefore there is study and learning. Buddha's way is unsurpassable, it will be accomplished. So, and this is part of the translation issues, you know, this makes perfect sense in Japanese culture, that there's not an emphasis on the I. But in our Western version, you know, we often individualize it as I. So I'm not going to ask you to change the chant, but maybe something to think about as we do this. Beings are